Tonight we're going to begin the seventh section of our class by talking about the idea of happiness through the conquest of nature, the transformation of the natural world. And the person I picked for this as an eloquent advocate of this view is Ayn Rand, although there are many other people who could be called advocates of this conception of the path to happiness as well. And really, it's pretty much the predominant view of most of the great modern philosophers from the beginning of what we call philosophical modernity. And some of the main figures that I would place in this general tradition would be, first of all, Sir Francis Bacon, René Descartes, Thomas Hobbes, Spinoza, Locke. These are the leading early modern philosophers. All of them were primarily 17th century philosophers. Bacon was the firstborn of them. He was born in the late 16th century. Descartes, Hobbes, Spinoza, Locke, they primarily lived during the 17th century. And interestingly enough, all of these figures fit in nicely with what we looked at last time, which was the tradition of Epicureanism, which is the definition of the good as pleasure. Now, the ancient Epicureans were ascetics, right? They believed that the kinds of pleasures that made life good were self-denying pleasures, simple pleasures, basic pleasures, and they tended to be apolitical, retired from life, and a pretty elitist bunch, because really only very few people can be expected to segregate themselves from society and deny themselves all the conventional pleasures of life, all the unnatural and unnecessary pleasures that society has to offer. The modern Epicureans were very different. What the modern Epicureans did is this. They recognized very early on the potential for modern science to radically transform man's way of living on Earth. Bacon saw this very early on, even before a lot of modern science existed. He saw the potentiality for a new form of scientific inquiry that would be consciously cultivated in order to produce technological spin-offs, and that these spin-offs would be used in order to improve the quality of people's life on Earth. Now, before the early modern thinkers, the idea of science was basically this. Science is a kind of disinterested activity that a few leisurely elitists pursue simply because they find it pleasurable in and of itself. But the idea that these scientific discoveries would be put to useful ends would be considered beneath them. This is something for craftsmen to do. Whereas these people were gentlemen, they were leisured people, they didn't work, they didn't stain their hands with toil, they had slaves to do that kind of work, human machines, and they didn't see any reason to invent mechanical devices to save on labor. Because if you saved on labor, what would you do with the teeming masses of people who were quite well employed, moving piles of stone around and things like that with basically their own muscle power, right? These people would be unemployed. It would cause social turmoil. The order of things would be upset. Who wants to set one foot on that slippery slope? So occasionally there would be machines created based on the scientific discoveries of the ancients, but they were basically toys. They were never to be used to lessen the burden of human beings. For instance, there was a Greek scientist named Hero of Alexandria who, on the basis of his observations about the nature of water and steam, created a steam-powered motor. It's a very simple thing. There was an enclosed container, a metal container filled with water that had holes in the top, and the holes basically conducted steam when the water was boiled. There was a fire built underneath, the water boiled, steam would go out up one thing, sort of pipe, and cause something to turn, and then it would condense and go back down the other side and be reheated. And everybody marveled at Hiro's engine, and then it was quietly forgotten. And the very idea that anybody could use this to, say, replace human muscle power would have been considered preposterous if anyone had suggested it. People like Bacon thought, well, this is somewhat mad, because isn't it the case that human beings live pretty nasty lives? At the time, people died of diseases that are easily prevented today. Infant mortality was enormously high. The average lifespan was rather short. Most people worked very hard for their daily bread. And the idea was, well, why don't we organize science in such a way that its activities are directed towards producing technologies, and the technologies are directed towards satisfying basic human needs. Now, there were a lot of views or attitudes that stood in the way of this, and these attitudes were primarily religious attitudes and also the attitudes of what you could call chivalry and aristocracy, the values of the knights and the nobility that looked down upon such things as, you know, beneath their concern. So the early modern thinkers availed themselves of the ancient Epicurean vision of man and the cosmos. The ancient Epicureans didn't have any place for gods that made any difference in human affairs, and therefore no one really had to worry about the gods. And the ancient Epicureans had absolutely no interest in things like honor, or history, or tradition. They were simply interested in cultivating the natural pleasures. Now, the modern Epicureans got rid of one feature of ancient Epicureanism, though, and that was its extremely ascetic and therefore elitist notion of pleasure. They said, look, we're going to have to cater to the pleasures of the vast majority of people. And what are those? Well, those are pleasures like eating and drinking and being merry and enjoying all kinds of silly luxuries, things like that. Unnatural, unnecessary things, too, as well as basic, natural, necessary desires. And so they tended to lower the standards of pleasure in order to broaden them out. And they really set in motion a process of social transformation which has brought us the world we live in today. The ancient Epicureans did not believe in any such thing as common good or any sort of political goods. They simply believed that politics was a matter was sort of a technology for assuring social peace, basically. It was a purely mechanistic system. There was no sense of an organic totality of society that had any kind of rights of its own. Society was simply a mechanism for assuring the safety and security of individual people. All of these notions were taken up and transformed by these early modern philosophers to give rise to the world we live in today, where the central project of our civilization is the mastery of nature. Why do we want to master nature? Well, to better satisfy our desires, to make us happier, to have a more enjoyable life, to have longer and more enjoyable lives. Remember, the ancient Epicureans were very interested in prolonging life. They were not particularly interested in honorable deaths. They didn't fight duels, they didn't go to wars, they didn't see any point in these things. They wanted to prolong life as much as possible, and modern human beings are very much oriented towards that too. We want to prolong life and take as much pleasure in it as we possibly can. Politics is really a kind of mechanism for the assurance of essentially private goods, right? And really the only criterion of political legitimacy that matters today is whether the political regime delivers the goods. We only have economic criteria of legitimacy today. Nothing else really matters, ultimately. And so modernity sort of grows out of a transformation of the hedonism that we saw in the last class. And it's a more populist hedonism, and therefore a more sensuous kind of hedonism, because most people are more sensuous than intellectual, and therefore the old-fashioned Epicureans were just too elitist in their conception of pleasure to appeal to the majority of human beings. But what the early modern thinkers did is they said, look, we can appeal to the vast majority of human beings and enlist them on our side to create a radically different world centered around science, technology, and ultimately around the satisfaction of human desires for earthly forms of happiness. And that's modernity. It's hard for the average guy to imagine that Epicurus was happy living in his little garden, eating gruel, and occasionally, when he was feeling kind of wild, partaking in some cheese.
Right.
That's about the wildest thing he ever did. The average bloke wants to eat considerably more cheese and other kinds of things than that, and we just couldn't enjoy life if we were eating nothing but gruel and drinking nothing but water, basically. So the modern Epicureans said, let's have more fun, but definitely life is about enjoying yourself, about having fun. Now, what happened as modern thought developed is this. This is what you can call sort of the first wave of modernity. The modern Epicureans. Then there became a kind of critical reaction to these people. And some of the philosophers who represent this critical reaction include people like Vico, who is an Italian philosopher, to some extent Hume, Scotsman, Rousseau, who is Swiss, and Immanuel Kant. Okay, the years we're talking about here, let me see if I can remember this correctly. Bacon was born in 1560, died in 1626. Descartes was born in 1596, died in 1650. Hobbes, I think, was born in, say, 1588, and died, I think, 90-odd years later. Yeah, he lived a very long time. Spinoza was much more short-lived, say, the 1630s to about 1669, I think those are about right. Locke was in the same framework. When you get to the later ones, Vico, he was born in 1688, or 1668, died 1744, Hume, 1710 to 1776. He died shortly after rejoicing in the news of the American Revolution. 1712 to 1778, and Kant was 1724 to 1804. So, when you get to the 18th century, these are 17th century, when you get to primarily 18th century thinkers, you get a reaction against this early form of modernism. And the basic reaction is this. There's something ignoble and low about people who are just concerned with basically filling their bellies and enjoying the comforts of life. And you can't really run a society with a bunch of people like this. In order to have a society, you have to have public-spirited individuals, and you have to have more exalted notions of legitimacy than just bringing home the bacon.
Exactly, no pun intended.
There have to be higher motivations than just hedonism, whether pursued long-term or short-term, rationally or irrationally. There's got to be a higher motivation in the human soul than just pleasure. And so a lot of these thinkers turn towards a notion of, we'll put it this way, a more heroic conception of morality. But what they try to do is they try to justify the project of the conquest of nature, not in terms of the satisfaction of basic human desires like the earlier modernists did, but they try to justify the conquest of nature, and this is particularly true with Rousseau and Kant, by arguing that this whole process really is a process by which human beings come to discover ourselves as somehow, you know, to use it very loosely terms, spiritual beings, that we have a moral nature, a kind of spiritual destiny, to be fulfilled through the process of remaking the world in our own image. So the reason why science and technology and the conquest of nature is a good thing is not that it produces bigger and better bathtubs, but because it's a process by which man discovers and concretizes the fact that he's somehow above nature and a being that deserves a certain amount of glory because of that. Okay. Now, Rand is a figure who fits in with the latter moderns in that sense. She really argues that the conquest of nature is the path to human happiness, but she isn't really a hedonist. She doesn't talk about satisfaction of any desire as the good. She really has a notion that only the satisfaction of rational desires is good, and that the purpose of life is to cultivate ourselves as rational beings, to discover ourselves as rational beings, and to cultivate that, and to put our stamp on the world in some sort. She has a very human-centered view of the cosmos. Man is the most important thing, and in order to discover and cultivate our nature, we have to put our stamp on the world around us by recreating it. And there's something heroic about this activity. It's not merely a matter of building bigger and better toys, but there's a deep spiritual meaning to work, if you want to put it that way. And so the first little passages I had you look at are these little passages from her novels. The first is from the novel The Fountainhead. The second is from the About the Author thing at the end of her last novel, Atlas Shrugged. It begins, "Howard Rourke laughed. He stood naked at the edge of a cliff. The lake lay far below him. A frozen explosion of granite burst in flight to the sky over motionless water. The water seemed immovable, the stone flowing. The stone had the stillness of one brief moment in battle when thrust meets thrust and the currents are held in a pause more dynamic than motion. The lake below was only a thin steel ring that cut the rocks in half. The rocks went on into the depth unchanged. They began and ended in the sky." So imagine rocks that are coming out of the water, but they're so mirrored in the water, right, that they look like they're floating in sky. You look above, you look below, there's sky. So there's the illusion that the thing is floating in space. "So that the world seemed suspended in space, an island floating on nothing, anchored to the feet of a man on the cliff." Now this is a nice sort of image expressing her human-centered view of the cosmos, right? Man isn't anchored to the earth. The earth is anchored to man, in some sense. Now, physically speaking, of course, we're anchored to the earth, right? But morally speaking, in her view, the earth is anchored to us. That, morally speaking, we're the center of the cosmos, and everything should properly revolve around us. So how do we make the cosmos revolve around us? Well, it's very simple. He looked at the granite. To be cut, he thought, and made into walls. He looked at a tree, to be split and made into rafters. He looked at a streak of rust on the stone and thought of iron ore under the ground, to be melted and to emerge as girders against the sky. These rocks, he thought, are here for me, waiting for the drill, the dynamite, and my voice, waiting to split, ripped, pounded, reborn, waiting for the shape my hands will give them. The point is that how do we make ourselves, or if we're morally the center of the universe, how do we make ourselves physically the center of the universe? Well, by reworking nature, by putting our stamp on nature. So nature here is regarded in itself as nothing of any real worth. It's simply a stockpile of resources for the expression of our humanity, if you will. It's a kind of stuff or a clay that human beings are to put our stamp on. And once it's stamped with our humanity, or the image of our humanity, then it attains some worth. Okay, but in and of itself, it really isn't worth anything. And this is a reflection of the idea that man, morally speaking, is the center of the cosmos, and that nature should properly be anchored to us and sort of revolve around us. Now, in the About the Author section from her novel Atlas Shrugged, she writes, I've held the same philosophy I now hold as far back as I can remember. I've learned a great deal through the years and expanded my knowledge of details, of specific issues, of definitions, of applications, and I intend to continue expanding it. But I have never had to change any of my fundamentals. My philosophy, in essence, is the concept of man as a heroic being with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with productive achievement as his noblest activity and reason as his only absolute. So this notion of productive achievement is absolutely central. And man's heroism is entirely caught up with our capacity to exercise our reason in the form of productive achievement, which involves science and technology and engineering and building and so forth, with the purpose being our own happiness, properly understood. Understood not merely in the sense of pleasure, or not merely in a hedonistic sense. Now, let me just tell you a bit about Rand, since I've set her in the context, I think, of modern philosophy. Because I think she had an interesting, really somewhat tragic life, even though her philosophy really denies that there's a tragic dimension to life. Her own life was really rather tragic. Anyway, let me just give you some dates. She was born in 1905 and died in 1982. Her given name was Alyssa Rosenbaum. She was born in Russia, of a Jewish family. And from 1905 to 26, she lived in Russia. Her family suffered a great deal during the Russian Revolution, and so she eventually got a visa to visit relatives in America and then never went back. From 1926 to, I think, 1935, if I recall properly, she lived in Hollywood. In 35, 43, it was New York. In 43, 51, it was back in Hollywood. And from 51 to her death, she went back to New York. She came to the United States. She wanted to get involved in pictures. So she went out to Hollywood and got a job as an extra and working in the wardrobe department at RKO and things like this. She met and married a man who was an extra on set of King of Kings, the big silent Cecil B. DeMille King of Kings. She was also an extra on that. And she wrote for the movies, and she also wrote a number of works that became published over the years. In 1936, she published her first novel, which is called We the Living. In 1943, was her most famous novel, really, The Fountainhead. And in 1957 was her biggest book, Atlas Shrugged. And then from about 61 on, she started putting out collections of essays under various titles, like The Virtue of Selfishness and Romantic Manifesto and so forth, that came out of various newsletters and things that she edited. She left Hollywood and went to New York and was there for about 8 years because of the success of a play that she wrote called Night of January 16. And she stayed in New York long enough to write The Fountainhead, and when the book, which came out at the beginning of 1943, became a success against all expectations, she sold the movie rights to it for $50,000, which was a lot of money then, went out and bought herself a mink coat, and then signed a deal with Hal Wallace Productions in Hollywood to be a screenwriter for him. And so she packed up and moved back to Hollywood. And she wrote screenplays for 5 films, 2 of which were never shot. One of them was 1944. It was called Love Letters. It had Joseph Cotten and Jennifer Jones in it. It's an interesting movie on the preposterous premise of a woman who kills her husband and has amnesia. In one of her letters, she talks about how preposterous an amnesia movie is, but she tried to make the best of it. In 1945, she did another film called You Came Along, which has Robert Cummings in it. I believe it's Bob Cummings is in it, and it's entertaining. These were sort of middle-brow pictures. That's what they hired her to write, sort of middle-brow, kind of serious romantic movies. In 1949, I believe it was, 49, Warner Brothers brought out Fountainhead as a movie, and you can rent this. I think the first half hour of the movie is really dreadful. And she really didn't think it could be made into a good film, and so she was the worst person to put in charge of the script. And the first 30 minutes are just dreadful because she's just trying to pack in as much of her ideas as possible, and it's just this sort of rapid machine gun fire of cliches back and forth out of all these people's mouths, and it's really hard to watch, and it becomes kind of laughable. But then if you sort of suffer through that, it starts getting better and better, and actually by the end it manages to capture a lot of the novel and to actually have some moving scenes. And it starred Gary Cooper and Patricia Neal and Raymond Massey, and it was a fairly successful movie. And the score by Max Steiner really is the best film score he ever composed. I think that it's very clear that Steiner read the novel, because he really captures the feel of the novel, which has a kind of heroic romanticism about it, but there's something extremely American about it at the same time. And Steiner's score really captures that. It has the kind of American quality that you associate with composers like Samuel Barber or Aaron Copland, with a kind of heroic, very European romanticism. It's a very nice combination. None of this fanfare for the common man kind of crap that she would have found so disdainful in Copland, all this folksy stuff. I love Copland, but she would have detested him, I'm afraid. Probably did detest him. He was a communist, after all. Until about 1943, when she finished Fountainhead, Rand was very much a kind of Nietzschean in her philosophical orientation. She was an extremely misanthropic elitist. Her journals have been published recently, and they have a lot of early writings in them that have never been published, and plans for novels and things like that, and they are just filled with extreme misanthropy and elitism. I actually find it rather refreshing, because later on she came to adopt a kind of, I think, entirely inconsistent sort of sentimental attachment to the common man. The idea that the average American is this very sensible bloke. It's just the intellectuals who are crazy. And I tend to think that that's entirely too optimistic. But anyway, she her early works are very Nietzschean, and especially her play Night of January the 16th and the first edition of the novel We the Living, very Nietzschean. And in 1942, a movie was made out of We the Living. Actually, two movies were made out of We the Living in Italy, in Mussolini's Italy. And I've been doing some work on this, and it's very interesting. Rand claimed that the movies were released and then pulled from circulation because they made the authorities uncomfortable, because in her words, they were just as much a condemnation of fascism as they were of communism. We the Living is set in Soviet Russia. It's very anti-communist. And that would surely be true if they made a movie of the second version of We the Living that she published in 1959. But it's certainly not true of the first edition, which is brimming with extremely elitist and really kind of fascist-sounding statements on the part of her main heroine, whose name is Kira. And, frankly, the Italians who were looking at this and thinking, well, this will be an edifying movie, couldn't really be blamed for thinking that she was in fundamental sympathy with their own views. And I think this was terribly embarrassing to her, and she sort of rewrote the history of the whole thing. And when she sued after World War II, and got the rights to the movie assigned to her. And in the late 60s, she worked on changing it, basically. And she never, in her lifetime, saw the movie actually changed. But it was released a little more than 10 years ago as a single movie, edited together from two-hour films into one film that's about 3 hours and 20 minutes long. And some parts of the dialogue, obviously many scenes were cut, and some of the dialogue was dubbed, or, you know, redubbed, you know, with different dialogue. And I think that, in part, that was necessary simply to change the historical record in a way, because it was acutely embarrassing to her, probably. And she didn't want this to be used as ammunition by her enemies, who were constantly smearing her as a fascist, even when it was quite untrue of her opinions. But around 1944, she basically sort of arrived at her full-fledged vision of things, which was basically this. Fountainhead's a kind of odd novel because, you know, Rand was later became a great defender of unregulated laissez-faire capitalism. That was her vision of the well-ordered society. But many people who read The Fountainhead were absolutely incredulous when they found out that Ayn Rand was an advocate of capitalism. And for the longest time I wondered why, but then I reread The Fountainhead and I realized, you know, the figure who represents the capitalist in there is this character, Gail Winand. And Winand is modeled after William Randolph Hearst, who really is the guy who turned American popular culture towards the toilet. Okay, he was an absolute cynic, but a business genius who created tabloid journalism in the United States.
Gave the people what they wanted.
He gave the people what they wanted, but he didn't just do that. He really corrupted people's tastes. And he got involved in movies and produced many, many truly crappy movies, lowbrow newsreels. He really turned the direction of American popular culture towards the gutter. And, you know, Jerry Springer is you know, his ultimate heir. Jenny Jones and people like that really are the people who have sort of cashed in the ultimate end of the kind of direction that he instituted. Why did he do it? Well, because there are more people with bad taste than there are good taste, and it's easier to corrupt people's tastes than to elevate them. So if your standard is making money, go for the crap. No one ever lost their shirt by underestimating the taste of the American public, was his basic premise. And there's a lot of truth to that.
What can corrupt something that was already bad?
Well, it's gotten worse, you know.
You can't appeal to something that's,
you know, we didn't have Howard Stern in the 1910s, right? We do have him today. Back to Howard Stern, right? We didn't have Jerry Springer, you know, 7 years ago, but we have him today, and you can plot a kind of downward course. But what Winand represents, Winand's the only out-and-out capitalist there, and he represents a kind of incredible cynicism where the pursuit of money is turned towards the corruption of culture in people's minds. And it's not surprising, therefore, that people thought that she was, whatever she was, she couldn't have been an advocate of that, right? But as it turned out, around 1944, really, a friend of hers, a woman named Isabel Patterson, who was the creator of a number of fairly minor novels. She took up novel writing because she couldn't knit very well, and she had to have something to relax with. And since she wasn't any good at knitting, she started writing novels. This is the kind of story that would, of course, drive Ayn Rand crazy, who took everything very seriously. Right? But anyway, she wrote a number of novels. Some of them were quite successful, but they've all been forgotten. But Isabel Patterson is extremely, very much self-educated, an extremely powerful political thinker, sort of in a class by herself. She encouraged Rand, or really convinced Rand, that the proper form of society was the original American system of government and a kind of laissez-faire, unregulated capitalist economy. And that became reflected in her last novel, Atlas Shrugged, which came out in 1957. In 1951, she decided that she wanted to devote all of her time to writing Atlas, so she got out of her contract with Hal Wallace, and she packed up and went to New York, and she stayed there for the rest of her life. And she published a number of books after Atlas Shrugged, all of them essays, basically, collections of essays. She never wrote another novel. She really only wrote three novels. There's a fourth book that's sort of a novella called Anthem that came out in the late 30s. Well, it was actually, I think, 1941 that was published in England. And it was republished in the United States in, 1948, I think it was, in a much revised edition. And again, the much revised edition of Anthem, in some ways, reflects her turn towards capitalism, away from a kind of Nietzschean elitism and misanthropy. Because there's something populist about capitalism. It empowers ordinary human beings. And in The Fountainhead, that's not looked on as a very pleasant thing, but later she became more, she had much more faith in the ordinary guy, so to speak. Brenda's very peculiar. From her very earliest novel to the very end of her life, she was constantly denying that there is any tragic dimension of reality or of life. And what is tragedy? Well, tragedy is simply this, that no matter how hard you try, sometimes little accidents come along and spoil things. In other words, the tragic dimension of life is simply the incapacity of mankind to control the world and assure ourselves of the realization of all of our plans. Now, it's possible, of course, to realize quite a lot of our plans and to do quite well. But the fact is that unless we had the power to control all the people around us and control all the circumstances of nature and the strange fluctuations and stirrings of society, we really don't have the capacity to map out a life and just go about living it according to an advanced plan in the same way that people build buildings or design transistors or whatever people do on this sort of engineering model, right? How many of us here expected, when we were, say, 17 or 18, to be doing what we're doing right now? Did any of us expect that this is what it would turn out to be?
Saying this specifically?
Specifically and generally. Okay, well, generally, well, good. I, frankly, didn't expect any of this to have happened to me when I was, say, 18 years old. I had no idea what I wanted to do in life. And I'm so glad that I didn't make a lot of plans then and get locked into something. Because, frankly, I would have, I think, suffered a great deal. And the fact is that why are most of us not where we expected ourselves to be when we were, say, 18? Because things emerge. Novelty emerges. Accidents happen. We discover new things about ourselves, right? Life is filled with unexpected things, and sometimes these things deeply frustrate or even destroy the values that we pursue. Now, Rand seemed to want to deny that, and her denial of the tragic dimension of life is very much related to her whole project of defining happiness as mastery and possession of nature, the transformation of the world. Right. Because it's precisely the element of the random, chance, fortune, or misfortune that one tries to calculate for and get out of the way in, say, engineering and building and things like that. And if you can engineer a life, well, why should there be any tragic dimension to it? Right. You know, Kant, again, for Rand, was her big nemesis, and the Stoics, I'm sure she would have been dismayed by if she had bothered to read them as well. But again, the Stoics begin with the principle there's some things you can control and some things you can't. What can't you control? Fate. Now, modern philosophy has been hard at work in pushing back the boundaries of fate, right? Of controlling more and more things. But the fact is that there's always going to be stuff we can't control. And if there are always going to be things that we can't control, that we can't anticipate, we can't plan for, then there's always going to be the possibility that if one makes one's happiness entirely dependent upon the success of projects, projects of transforming things in the world, that one will be sorely disappointed. And this is why the Stoics, people like Kant and so forth, Socrates very clearly, argued that the route to happiness is not the pursuit of happiness in the sense of trying to create happiness by changing one's environment, changing people around oneself, transforming the world. We have to do that, and we should do it to the extent that's necessary, but that the main source of happiness and the main route to happiness is to work on the things that we can control, and that's the inner man, right? The inner self, our character. And that means that when it comes to action, general rules, right, principles of morality are more important, really, than goals, or pursuing goals. So that, in a sense, one's primary concern should be pursuing worthiness to be happy by pursuing goodness of character. Because one can't pursue happiness directly because of the fact that there's just this dimension of tragedy that's built into life. Rand was a great enemy of the idea of focusing one's life on, in a way, self-cultivation or acting according to general principles, duty, and things like that, because she had a very optimistic view of the possibility of pursuing happiness by changing the world. And this required her, throughout her writings, I think, to soft pedal and ultimately deny whatever dimension of tragedy there is in life. The greatest example of this, in her own life, there's a movie that was brought out recently on television called The Passion of Ayn Rand, which was based on a biography of her by Barbara Brandon, who was associated with her for about 18 years. And Barbara Brandon's husband had an affair with Ayn Rand for quite a long time, and he was 25 years younger than her. And they started their affair when she was in her, I guess, late 40s. Okay. Carried it on until she was in her mid-60s. They sort of broke off. She broke off the affair in the late 50s because she was severely depressed after Atlas Shrugged came out, which is itself something that has no place in her philosophy. You know, but she was clinically depressed for several years, really, and she could barely do anything, barely put pen to paper, barely stirred from her apartment and everything like that. But anyway, in the meantime, Nathaniel Brandon, her lover, got another girlfriend and kept it from Rand until 1968. But by which time she wanted to resume their relationship, she was, 63 years old at that time? And he said no. And she couldn't figure out why. Now, to her credit, she recognized that it could have been the fact that she was just too old and that she didn't turn him on anymore. And she would ask him these things, and he would say, oh, no, it's not that, it's not that. But he would never say what until she found out what it was, that he was carrying on with some other woman. And this really devastated her, and this led to a break. But the thing is that the whole affair was hatched from the beginning on the assumption that somehow we can avoid tragedy in life. Because she had a meeting. She decided she wanted to have an affair with a man 25 years her junior. So what does she do? Well, she gets the guy and his wife and her husband all together, and she says, I'm going to have an affair with a younger man. And she demanded that both spouses approve of this fact and go ahead with this. And her basic argument was, if we were lesser people, we could never risk this. But we're better than that. You know, we're better than the average person. And we can take it. We can, this won't harm us. I just want to do this. I need this for my own self. This is my route to happiness. I know, you know, I made commitments to monogamy and things like that in my wedding vows, and I know that society expects that. But that's for lesser people. We can handle this. We can go outside the boundaries, right? And, well, as it turned out, that wasn't true, and that there were dreadful consequences. Her husband basically dissipated himself into alcoholism. He drank himself into a not to an early grave. He lived a fairly long time, but he was certainly senile when he wasn't drunk.
Did they divorce?
No. He stayed with her. He was totally dependent upon her. He never understood her. But he was totally dependent on her, so he really couldn't have a life on his own. He was very, very hostile towards her after a while. And really, when the affair blew up, she really sort of was destroyed by it psychologically. His wife started suffering pathological anxiety attacks and things like this. The only person who seemed to come out of it relatively unscathed was Nathaniel Bandon, who's managed to write two books brimming with self-esteem about the whole thing. But the thing is that Rand was really destroyed by this psychologically and really became this sort of paranoid, embittered old woman who was, surrounded by a bunch of pygmies, a sort of court of intellectual pygmies who were constantly flattering her. And this is how she lived the rest of her life. And it was very sad. If Kant were to pronounce judgment, he would say, if she had just done her duty, right, if she had just followed the general principles that have been set down since time immemorial, that you don't mess with matters of the heart, none of this would have happened. But she thought that she could play by different rules, right, that she could make it work, whereas lesser people might not have been able to. But it really ended up destroying virtually everybody involved. The only person who wasn't destroyed, really, was Brandon, Nathaniel Brandon, and it was only because, in some way, I think he's a very, very scary kind of character, and it didn't really affect him that deeply anyway. So, I mean, this is sort of a case history, in a sense, of how the tragic dimension of life creeps back to haunt us when we try and, Horace talks about nature, you can try and chase it out with a broom, but it will creep in through the back window again. And there's some truth about tragedy, too. You can try and deny that it exists in life, but it always creeps back in, and sometimes it's unleashed precisely by the kind of hubris that denies that it's a possibility. All right, let's, in our 30 minutes remaining, talk about the Apollo 11 piece. Anyway, the Apollo 11 essay, I thought, was, and also the sequel, Epitaph for a Culture, I thought were really good things to choose for Rand for this reason. What's really essential about Ayn Rand, both the early Ayn Rand and the more mature Ayn Rand, the later Ayn Rand, is this. The thread that goes through all of her thinking is this kind of heroic humanism, this conquest of nature kind of philosophy. Before she settled on capitalism as her preferred system of government or order of society, she was still a believer in the conquest of nature and man's heroic destiny and so forth. In her early writings, even though she wasn't apparently an advocate of laissez-faire capitalism, she was still an advocate of this heroic notion of man as having a destiny to transform nature and in his own image. And so this essay, I think, captures what's essential to Rand from the beginning to the end of her thought. Her views on politics and ethics evolved over time. But the thread that goes through it all is this, and I think that this is a beautiful kind of encapsulation of it in the form of some very good journalism. I think it's very well done. She could write extremely well. She was really a fine novelist, and her skills as a novelist also made her very good as a journalist. She's really good at capturing concrete things and narrating concrete events in a way that gives you a sense of their larger significance. This is why she wrote novels, and this is why in her later years she turned more and more to a kind of philosophical journalism. She published a newsletter in the 1970s called the Ayn Rand Letter, and a lot of the essays in there deal with events of the time and try and draw larger lessons out of them. And they're extremely good as well-written pieces of thoughtful journalism. I really think that there's a kind of glow over her late essays. She was a master of the put-down. She could write very amusingly, and She has this late essay called The Age of Envy, I think it was around 1970, where she goes a little bit off her rocker, really, condemning the environmentalists and the feminists. And there's this one line where she talks about the hippies who would pollute any stream by stepping into it. She was very much against women's liberation, and she called herself a male chauvinist pig. She had this one line about women moaning about being treated as sex objects, but obviously in no danger of that. Well, the thing is that she held men above herself. She defined femininity as man worship, and the idea of the equality of the sexes, to her, seemed terribly unsexy. Yes, she was a male chauvinist. You know, she had the courage of her convictions. She actually announced it publicly and was, held to a great deal of scorn. Ayn Rand, she was the kind of woman who liked this sort of rough-and-tumble, bodice-ripper kind of sex. The kind of sex that you find in Harlequin romances and all these novels that women consume in enormous quantities, and therefore it has to appeal to some of them, besides Ayn Rand, but she was one of the only people who would admit it, you know, publicly. Anyway, so let's just talk about this essay. You know, it's got all of her themes in it. She describes Titusville. She talks about how it had too many churches. She was a big secularist, and the idea of this, all these engineers and scientists having all these churches around was vaguely disturbing. But at least they were modern-looking things, she said. She talks about the bottom of 163. This is sort of her vision of how the world should be. About six lines from the bottom, she talked about the family that she stayed with. They had a quality of cheerful openness, directness, almost innocence, the benevolent, unself-consciously self-confident quality of those who live in the clean, strict, reality-oriented atmosphere of science. This is the world she wanted to live in. She talks about how, you know, the subtropical growth is cut by all these roads and things like that, and of course she likes that. One line that made me smile when I first read this, and makes me smile again, is on the bottom of 162, when she talks five lines from the bottom, this parched stubble of grass under her feet, with its wholesomely usual touches of litter. After all, litter is something human, right? And by littering the world, we make it more our own. she would go to no end. You know, at one point in an essay, you know, condemning ecology, she said that people should go and find the biggest, grimiest smokestack they can find and thank it for their standard of living. But I love it. So she exalts litter. Well, it's human. On the bottom of 166, you know, she sort of sums up what this is all about. And on 167, too. The second to the last paragraph on 166, about 8-10 lines from the bottom, says, what we had seen after the moon launch is over, in naked essentials, but in reality, not in a work of art, was the concretized abstraction of man's greatness. This is why the moon launch was such a great thing for her, because it made concrete the idea of man's greatness, okay, that people could, over so many years, develop this space program and actually send man to the moon. For her, it made more concrete and real than anything else in history, in her view, just how great mankind was. And why? Well, because, you know, it's deeply symbolic, and writers with very different orientations, like Hannah Arendt, for instance, saw this too. Rand wasn't the only person who saw this as an absolutely momentous event in intellectual history. And depending on one's basic premises about morals, obviously one interprets it rather differently. And one of the things she derides in here is the fact that most of the intellectuals who were interviewed didn't appreciate this for what it was. Instead, they would gripe about the fact that this money could have been spent on slum clearing and, you know, picking up litter and things like that. For her, that's not important. You know, there's something ignoble about a society where its priorities are directed towards the weak, the poor, things like that, rather than towards the great. And so this is her kind of Nietzscheanism coming out. There's something elevating about human beings trying to rise above themselves. And there's something deeply deformative of the human soul to spend your time always looking down for ones below you. Right? And so the whole welfare state for her represented a kind of inversion of the proper values and the proper perspective towards values, which should be to look up to something that's grand rather than to look down to something that's pitiful. And on the top of 167, about 8 lines down, there's this line, "For once, if only for 7 minutes, the worst among those who saw it had to feel not how small is man by the side of the Grand Canyon, but how great is man and how safe is nature when he conquers it." This really represents two different types of people. There are some people who, when they look at the cosmos, feel very small. And there are people like Ayn Rand, when they look at the cosmos, say, well, you know, what a challenge. For her, that's sort of a way of separating the sheep from the I don't know what, the wolves. It is a real separator. You sort people in terms of their reactions to things. And she had no appreciation for the people who felt small. Kant was a sort of interesting mixture. When he just talks about this notion of the sublime, he says it's a kind of dual feeling. And he specifically calls it the dynamic sublime. And what does that mean? Well, it means a vision of something of enormous power. Okay, so for instance, contemplating the vastness of space, or an ocean in the middle of a storm, or something like the Grand Canyon, a great depth, or something like that, does produce in us a kind of sinking feeling, a sense of our smallness and weakness, he says. But at the same time, for him, it also should produce a sense of elevation. And the sinking and the elevation are correlated to different parts of us. The sinking feeling is our awareness of ourselves as merely physical entities, and measured against the vastness of the cosmos, we as physical entities are very fragile, very small, really worth nothing. You know, we can be extinguished in a second by the stray asteroid or a bit of antimatter. So it goes poof, and that's the end of all of our fine ideas about ourselves. But he says, at the same time, if one views this spectacle of power from a vantage point of safety, someone's not feeling terror, right? He says it's like seeing a shipwreck out at sea from safety. It's a horrifying spectacle, but because you're not on the ship, you can regard it as a kind of aesthetic phenomenon rather than be caught up in it. And he's saying that at the same time, you are horrified and shrink as a physical being. He says one should have a rebound of exaltation when one recognizes that, morally speaking, we're of infinite worth compared to these mere stars and mere storms, mere holes in the ground like the Grand Canyon. So, you know, Kant has both sides of this phenomenon. And he says that this traditional notion of the sublime, which is an aesthetic concept that refers to a kind of mixed emotion where there's both a sinking feeling and a kind of shudder combined with a sense of exaltation, is really a sign of man's dual nature. That as physical beings, we're very small and fragile, but as moral and rational beings, we have infinite worth and the capacity to perhaps master the world, in some sense. And there is some truth to that. For Kant, the people who only feel small, well, maybe they need to stick around and wait for, or think about themselves and their worth as moral beings to get that sort of exaltation. It's a sign of low self-esteem if you just feel small all the time. But if people esteem themselves merely as natural beings, it's quite reasonable to have fairly low self-estimations, because in the economy of nature, the individual means nothing, really. But if you look at ourselves as moral beings, you know, as beings with a soul, if you will, or a spirit, however you want to describe that in a mystical or a purely secular sense, there's a kind of uniqueness and a kind of value, if you will, a kind of dignity that attends to having a rational nature and the capacity to exercise freedom and be responsible that seems to be of infinitely greater worth than anything merely physical. So Rand is dealing with concepts here that are very ancient. She's taking her stand on this. And then she talks about how the next 4 days went by during the whole lunar mission and how everyone was glued to the television watching this. She also wrote an essay called Apollo and Dionysus, which is really a rather, again, it's a rather wicked piece. It's full of lots of put-downs and some real satire. People criticized her for not having much of a sense of humor, and she really was the kind of person you didn't get jokes, but she was absolutely masterful at satire. Her novels are filled with absolutely hilarious satirical passages. And this essay, Apollo and Dionysus, is an essay contrasting the moon launch and the million or so people who showed up to watch Apollo 11 versus Woodstock, which represents Dionysus. And the Woodstock crowd comes off looking very badly compared to the million or so people who came and left. They did leave some litter behind, but for her that's not so bad. Far less litter, as it turns out, than was left at Woodstock. But anyway, it's really well worth reading. It's a very negative view of the 60s. Counterculture, no question about it. I got so sick of people reminiscing about the 60s, though, that I photocopied that article and started shoving it at them when I was an undergraduate, because I said, you know, I don't want to hear about the good old days of the counterculture. And on page 168 near the bottom, her sort of secularism comes out in a very nice little passage about 10 lines from the bottom. Neil Armstrong is about to set foot on the surface of the moon. And she's thinking, oh, God.
Don't
say anything about God, please. She was thinking, well, I don't want any repeat of the guy who orbited the moon quoting from the Bible. Well, what a shudder that probably produced of her. So, at this last, I felt one instant of unhappy fear, wondering what he would say, because he had it in his power to destroy the meaning and the glory of that moment, as the astronauts of Apollo 8 had done in their time by talking about God, reading Genesis or something. He did not. He made no reference to God. He did not undercut the rationality of his achievement by paying tribute to the forces of its opposite. He spoke of man. That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. So it was. Then she goes on and talks about sort of the whole politics of it. She thinks that the motivation for the space race was all wrong, that the United States should not have been competing for prestige with the Soviet Union. And really, when you get right down to it, that's why we had the space program that we did have. John F. Kennedy was very much obsessed with issues of prestige, style, not substance, really. You know, there was this one record of a meeting in the White House where he was actually hysterical, questioning people. I think he was questioning Lyndon Johnson, who had lots of ties with the aerospace industry in Texas, and of course was all too happy to, you know, spend billions of dollars on a space program. And he was saying, isn't there anything that we can beat them at? Can we send up a bigger satellite? Can we send a man to the moon? And this is where the whole space program came from. You know, the whole goal of getting a man on the moon was simply because Kennedy wanted the prestige of the United States beating the Soviets. You know, they'd sent Sputnik up before us. They were using this for making hay out of propaganda, so our prestige required that we outdo the Soviets, and so this was simply a race for prestige. Now, Rand has no appreciation for things like this, but frankly, I don't see any reason why societies can't be oriented towards things that are kind of glorious. She wrote this very scathing essay about monuments called The Monument Builders, which is an attack on the pursuit of public prestige by building monuments. I remember there's this hilarious essay by P.J. O'Rourke where it talks about a trip he made with a bunch of American leftists to the Soviet Union in its late years. And he talked about all the monuments, and he sort of narrated what the tour guide was saying, and one line always cracked me up. And the monument over here in the foreground is a monument to that monument over there in the background. But they did spend an enormous amount of, money, sweated out of hungry people on erecting ugly marble things, which have now fallen down or have been scrapped for prestige, right? And, but at the same time, Rand did talk in her essay on Apollo and Dionysus about the parade that happened in New York City when the astronauts from Apollo 11 returned, and how it was a real sort of focus and created a kind of sense of community and a sense of benevolence. Right? And I don't see any reason why people should regard the creation of that sort of sense of communal pride as something unworthy of the government to undertake. You know, it could sure as hell do a lot worse with tax dollars than do certain things that are rather glorious and sort of provide a focus around which communal feelings and pride can sort of gel. Because God knows there are few enough instances of you know, communal feeling or civility in America today. Right. So, for her, the bottom line is this, and this really indicates just how, what's really important for her, and this is at 177 at the bottom, last line, as far as, quote, national priorities are concerned, I want to say the following. We do not have to have a mixed economy. We still have a chance to change our course and thus to survive. But if we do continue down the road of a mixed economy, then let them pour all the millions and billions they can into the space program. If the United States is to commit suicide, let it not be for the sake and support of the worst human elements, the parasites on principle at home and abroad. Let it not be its only epitaph that it died paying its enemies for its own destruction. Let some of its lifeblood go to the support of achievement and the progress of science, the American flag on the moon, or on Mars, or on Jupiter, will at least be a worthy monument to what had once been a great country. And so really, when you get dig down to it, it's the glory thing, the heroic glory thing, that really is, for her, what's essential. And it really, she started out that way, and it goes all the way through her thought. Of course, there is no surface of Jupiter to plant a flag on. It's just a big ball of gas. But still, the epitaph for a culture is a rather nice elegiac sort of piece about the cancellation of the space program, and I just attach that because it, you know, sort of closes on a kind of elegiac, sad note. Rand is, I think, an extremely eloquent writer in favor of the idea that the happy life is a life of heroic, productive achievement, the mastery of nature, the conquest of nature. And the expression of human character by putting its stamp upon the world. Another thinker who really has this kind of heroic conception of the conquest of nature, I mentioned Rousseau and Kant, but the person who really does is Hegel. And in a very ironic sense, of course, Marx also has a rather heroic sense of labor. You know, the work of man's conquest of the world, its spiritual meaning. It's an overcoming of one's alienation from the world and an expression of our nature. We come to know ourselves by transforming things into images of ourselves. That's the sense.